The following is an encore presentation that first aired on December 7, 2021. This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on December 2nd. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky. From the website of the Texas Jail Project, the overwhelming majority of folks featured in a digital publication of the organization are legally innocent. Most are arbitrarily assigned high bail, which they cannot afford, especially if they are people of color. The court system has slowed to a crawl during the pandemic, and so those held pretrial are trapped in a system best described as a combination of a poorhouse and a plantation. Awaiting trial, our community members are likely to lose their jobs, homes, and even families. Often traumatized by the chaotic conditions, many are also exposed to COVID-19, experience medical neglect, and fail to receive medications that they were prescribed on the outside. In short, pretrial incarceration has become a potential death sentence, inflicting incalculable pain on our communities. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guests this evening write for the Texas Observer. Sophie Novak is an editor and reporter who often covers public health. Michael Barajas is a staff writer who covers civil rights issues, especially incarceration, and has been a frequent guest on this show. Sophie and Michael recently co-authored an article titled Locked Up and Left to Die. Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of the show, also joins us. Our regular guest, Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, is otherwise occupied trying to disbar the Attorney General of the state of Texas. So there. Thanks for joining us, Sophie and Mike. Please introduce yourselves.
Thanks again for having us. I think you already gave me a pretty good introduction there, but I write and edit for the Texas Observer, mostly covering healthcare, and I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm Mike Barajas. I write about civil rights issues at the Observer, and that's often about mass incarceration and criminal punishment issues and jail conditions even, which is kind of where this project comes in.
Tell us about the genesis of the article. As I was reading through it, it sounds like you did quite a bit of research on this.
Yeah. So in big picture, you know, like I said, I cover mass incarcerations, conditions in lockups and situations in lockups across the state, but often that's on county jail conditions. We've done a lot of separate stories on, you know, individual either tragedies or different exposés into particular jails on particular issues. And Sophie has helped me with some of those as an editor. As part of that coverage, we started to think about a more maybe big picture, holistic way to look at these. And that's kind of where the records come in, the Texas Rangers reports giving us a pretty big sample of what deaths in jail custody look like up close.
We did start talking about this project a while back now. It took a long time to get all of these records. And I think it originated with this idea of kind of thinking about the intersection of both of our coverage areas and wanting to learn more about generally folks who are being mistreated and dying in jails in Texas, but started out kind of especially interested in cases in which folks were not getting the medical attention they needed, kind of this intersection of healthcare and incarceration, and wanting to look at that and issues around that kind of more broadly, thinking that a lot of the kind of media coverage on this issue has been focused on one-off specific cases and wanting to take, as Mike mentioned, a more kind of holistic view of it.
You must have spent a lot of time. I mean, we'll get into that in a minute here, but it looks like you reviewed hundreds and hundreds of cases, investigations by the Texas Rangers. Maybe just to start off, I know we've had the Texas Jail Project on here a couple of times too, and they're always very adamant about distinguishing between jails and state prisons, for example, county jails and state prisons. Could either one of you just give us a thumbnail sketch, you know, when does somebody go to jail? When does somebody go to prison?
Yeah, I can take that real quick if you want me to, Sophie. It's just jails, county jails, the facilities that we're talking about here are primarily places where people are there for pretrial detention. So they may have been charged or accused of some sort of criminal act. And it could range the gamut from criminal trespass, which is the case in some of the instances we looked at, to more serious allegations. But the vast majority of people are pretrial. They're legally innocent. They haven't been convicted. Whereas state prison, you know, those are people that have been adjudicated by the courts and have been sentenced.
So a lot of these people, well, they're all presumed to be innocent. Now, some of them could be post-trial awaiting assignment to a prison, right?
Yeah, they could be that, or, you know, it was the case in one of the people who died in the Nueces County jail that we wrote about. He was there for a probation violation. The vast majority of cases that go through the criminal justice system are not handled with the trial. They're handled with some sort of either plea agreement that might defer prison time if they stay out of trouble, or some sort of court-ordered monitoring or something like that. So you'll see people like that often cycling in and out of a county lockup because of a probation violation or something.
So there's one jail in every county, right? So there's 254 jails in the state of Texas?
About that, not exactly. I think it's like 238 or 239 was the last count. Fluctuates sometimes based on, you know, what the, like a contract with a private company. That's not the most common thing, but that a few of those do exist in the state. But yeah, about 240 or so.
So Sophie, you've been covering health issues. Tell us about the environment in a jail.
Sure. So I think, you know, when I've mentioned this project to some folks as we were working on it, some people assumed that we were writing about the pandemic and how that's playing out in jails. And that's actually not the focus here, but I think that really underlines a lot of the kind of pre-existing conditions in some of these facilities, specifically things like overcrowding, unsanitary conditions. The pandemic has, in a number of ways, kind of stalled court hearings, and also just kept folks, I guess the pandemic and the actions of state officials have kept more folks in jails and kind of exacerbated some of those conditions that we are seeing here, which of course is a problem, you know, in terms of getting people the resources they need, getting people the medical attention they need, et cetera.
In my impression of a jail, and I've not spent much time in them, gratefully, my impression is that there's a lot of turnover. There's turnover of prisoners. There's turnover of visitors, of lawyers. I mean, trying to isolate a population during a pandemic must be nigh impossible.
Yeah, we've talked before on the program, Bob, right, about some of the challenges the state prison system faced with COVID. I mean, it's pretty similar with really any lockup setting, like as you said. Yeah, social distancing and a lot of the other precautions that we were allowed to take on the outside just weren't possible in a, you know, incarcerated setting. And yeah, and then to all the points that Sophie just mentioned about the things that we document in this report, in this investigation, right? Those are like, all those problems were really exacerbated by the pandemic because it was just one more huge stressor to an already burdened system. So
And Sophie, you mentioned politics, for example. I seem to recall early on in the pandemic, there were a number of judges that were really trying to empty out the jails as much as possible. And I think there was a lot of goodwill on the part of a lot of judges, but somebody intervened in that, right?
That's right. Governor Greg Abbott was not too keen on that. I think Mike can probably speak to some of the kind of politics there better than I can, but today, actually on December 2nd, new law went into effect in Texas that the advocates have said will just make it kind of more difficult, especially for poorer folks to get out of jail, kind of limiting bail for folks who have been accused of violent crimes. But yes, as well, in kind of earlier months in the pandemic, there were efforts to block folks from getting out of these facilities. And we saw in Nueces County, for example, that one of the jails that we focused on, the Texas Commission on Jail Standards found them out of compliance again recently for overcrowding. They were actually having to transfer people in their facilities to other jails because they weren't able to hold them all there.
I mean, you guys in the article, you cite a number of statistics, but the one that just blew me away, you said there's like a million people cycle through jails annually, through Texas jails annually. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, jails are, like you said, there's a lot of turnover, and for all the reasons that we kind of described, where people who encounter police or other, you know, law enforcement officials at a lot of different stages kind of end up there, or, you know, somebody shows up for a court hearing, then they get taken into custody, or, you know, there's just a lot of different ways to end up in jail. You're not always there for a super long period of time. As we, you know, document in the investigation, you don't have to be there for a long period of time for things to go incredibly wrong and turn fatal. But yeah, there's a lot of turnover. That just shows you, that's another sort of number that I think reveals like the scope, like the scale of mass incarceration, right? Just that many bodies churning through these facilities.
You know, the population of the state's about 29 million. I mean, yeah, percentage-wise, that's a lot of people, you know? And your articles, you say that the Texas Rangers have filed 622 cases over the past decade. It looks like you guys reviewed over 400. Could you give us a thumbnail sketch about some of the statistics, causes of death, and what did you observe in the work of the Texas Rangers? And what was your first impression upon reviewing all this material?
Yeah, Sophie, do you want to take that first? I mean, I think Sophie has an interesting perspective on this because she's covered the medical side of a lot of this. So she had a pretty fresh set of eyes on some of these problems, which I thought was really helpful to the project.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a big question, right? It's there were a lot of things we kind of chronicle here. I guess I'll start by saying, like Mike mentioned, I don't have kind of a history of myself reporting on jails and prisons, and reading through just this huge amount of reports on these just really, really awful, devastating cases was really difficult. It was kind of the sheer volume of it combined with just how awful a lot of these situations and these cases were.
And for the Texas Rangers to get involved, it's already got to be at an extreme, right?
It depends. After 2018, the Texas Rangers started doing a lot more of these investigations because reforms in the Sandra Bland Act made that so. Yeah, it's part of the situation. Yeah. Yes and no. Yeah.
Okay. Go on, Sophie. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's fine. So I just kind of mentioned that to start. So Mike and I went through all of these reports and kind of tried to distill them both in terms of numbers that we would be able to pull out in terms of tracking some of the red flags that we were seeing, some of the patterns we were finding in terms of how folks were being treated or red flags that were missed or, you know, actions on the part of jail staff. It's kind of creating this database of those to pull out, you know, some numbers to kind of provide a top line summary of what we were finding. We went through more than 400 investigations over the last decade. We found dozens of cases where the Rangers were documenting various allegations of mistreatment, which could be, you know, confiscating medicine, denying medical treatment to folks in the facilities, abuse by jail staff, et cetera. You know, not following state law in terms of cell checks that were required for people who had certain flags on their medical or suicide screenings when they were booked into the facility. A large portion of those were particularly alarming. We found a large number of cases in which the Rangers documented specific allegations that jail staff had specifically dismissed outcries for help or, you know, folks saying that they needed medical attention before they died. I'll kind of step back for a second here to say, you know, these kinds of findings are based on what we were reading in these Rangers reports. So they're almost certainly kind of underestimates in what we're talking about, because these are situations in which the Rangers not only found evidence of XYZ thing, but also decided to include it in their report. So some of these things could be true in many other cases, and they're just not documented in the reports that we were going through. But they were regularly documenting, you know, jail conditions in which jail staff were just taking a really long time to respond to outcries for help, medical emergencies, et cetera, were violent towards detainees who were in the middle of mental health crises, denying treatment for conditions like heart attacks or diabetes, et cetera. I'll stop talking for a second and kind of let Mike jump in. But those were kind of a few of the things that we were finding. And we tried to, in our investigation, you know, intertwine those with conversations, interviews that we had with family members, and kind of, you know, more kind of narrative representations of what folks were going through in these county jails.
Sure. I think what surprised me was just the high number of suicides. But go ahead, Michael.
Oh, I was just going to say that, I mean, I think Sophie flagged a lot of the kind of methodically go through these and categorize the red flags that we're seeing all over the place. She sort of spotlighted a lot of the really troubling ones. I mean, I think just generally speaking for me, I mean, these are state police records, right? That like county officials, that people have access to. And these records show some pretty like incredibly disturbing things, just regularly documenting jail conditions that we know can lead to preventable deaths. Yeah, like Sophie said, the process itself was a little overwhelming just because there's so much trauma in these reports. There's so much trauma in these facilities that are revealed in these Rangers investigations that, yeah, it's happening pretty frequently across these types of dangerous conditions. So,
what's your sense about the quality of the casework that was done by the Texas Rangers? I mean, is it pretty consistent? Are they missing details a lot of times? What was your overall sense of that?
I would say not at all consistent in terms of kind of the things that they're tracking, how comprehensive they were, the types of information they're including. So a lot of the reports, you know, we had some reports that were over 100 pages long for one in custody death and were extremely detailed. And then we saw some that were, you know, 3 pages long. Some of them didn't include information about how the person died or the, you know, any of the kind of autopsy findings. So it really varied a lot, the degree to which the Rangers were talking to other people who were incarcerated in the jail and might have witnessed what happened varied a lot based on the case. The degree to which they talked to jail staff varied as well. So I would say, yeah, it depended a lot on kind of the facility, the Ranger doing the investigation, of course. Over time, you know, we looked at these over 10 or 11 years. There were a number of different factors there.
Yeah, like the limitations of these reports. Yeah, I mean, I think it's like kind of speaks to, yeah, what's documented in the red flags that we do see, like just being kind of a tip of the iceberg situation. Because, yeah, like Sophie said, there are some that are really, really cursory, even though some details in those reports, you know, raise questions. Like, yeah, I've written about, you know, the Tarrant County jail before, in part because deaths have spiked there in recent years. And at the same time, like during that time, they've had like a pretty vocal right-wing reactionary sheriff that local organizers there have sort of been trying to replace. And the Rangers investigations into some of those deaths, I mean, they were super cursory, even though they were cases involving some pretty troubling stuff, like people being pepper sprayed, tackled, or like strapped into restraint chairs by jail staff before they died. So yeah, I think there's some pretty startling oversights in some of these investigations as well.
There's supposedly a state agency, if I've got this correct, TCJS, that's supposed to be setting standards and monitoring the conditions in jails. That's been around for a while, right? Is that the Texas Commission on Jail Standards? Is that right?
That's right. And that was established in 1975.
Oh, wow. So it has been around for almost 50 years. It's a huge agency that carefully monitors each and every jail, right? Being facetious.
So you have read the story. Yeah, I mean, what's kind of interesting about that state agency, or I guess, you know, another red flag in all of this is how little that agency has changed despite, you know, pretrial detention growing so exponentially since that body was created. Yeah, it's a pretty skeleton crew over there, pretty like a shoestring budget. What was it, Sophie? It's like 3 or 4 inspectors at any given time for the 240 jails in the state. And that's the same as it was decades ago.
Which obviously, you know, really limits what they're able to do in terms of actually holding these facilities or their staff accountable.
And if I got it right from your article, there were more than 36 jails that did not meet the minimum standards set by that agency, right?
I believe those are ones that are kind of regularly not meeting standards. I mean, any given year, you have a very significant number that TCJS is finding out of compliance in its annual inspection. What we saw were facilities, and, you know, again, we focus on the Nueces County Jail for a lot of the story, and that was one where we really saw this occurring, where it was just cycling in and out of compliance over decades, really. And not really facing any consequences from TCJS for that. It's kind of like inspectors do their inspection and might find a jail out of compliance for generally like paperwork related issue or other kind of, you know, very kind of specific way that facility is not meeting minimum standards. And then the jail has the opportunity to rectify that, and they might go back into compliance. And then a few months later, they might be found out of compliance again in a follow-up inspection. And we saw a number of facilities that were regularly kind of cycling in and out.
And I'm guessing that not a lot of jails have been shut down for being out of compliance. Is that a fair estimate?
Right. I mean, I think what's interesting about the kind of like regulatory structure that we're talking about here is that like lawmakers are aware of this. It's been pretty well documented, not just by advocates and civil rights lawyers and people that, you know, sometimes sue over these conditions. But the state watchdog agency, the Texas Sunset Commission, recently did its report on the jail commission and said that, yeah, the regulatory structure is kind of what like it leads to this cycle of noncompliance where jails are just routinely failing minimum standards and aren't really held accountable. They do have the power, though they really use it, like you said, to shut down a jail or order corrective action. They just very rarely do that, almost never do that. And the commission has been criticized for essentially deferring to local sheriffs that run most of these facilities, that it's, you know, an elected county sheriff that oversees the local county jail in almost all of these places. And I guess you can maybe kind of see why that is. You know, they're the like elected official at the table, or at least that's been the excuse for sort of deferring to them in some of these cases of perpetual noncompliance. I mean, like the biggest jail in the state, like the Harris County Jail, is also a repeat violator here. And that's despite having a sheriff that's been, you know, lauded, I think, somewhat appropriately for having, you know, been a reform-minded law enforcement official. But still, yeah, these problems, these challenges are systemic.
And I think what's interesting too about that dynamic is that Texas is actually, at least on paper, pretty good with this stuff compared to other states. I mean, a lot of other states don't have a body like TCJS at all. Some states aren't tracking in custody deaths really at all. And so comparatively, you know, TCJS what experts and advocates have said is pretty good at doing this kind of very narrow thing. But what the state doesn't have is a kind of larger oversight body that is able to look more holistically at what is going on in these facilities, at some of these kinds of patterns and red flags that, like Mike and I were doing, and identifying those kinds of problems and solutions in a way that would, you know, really resolve them versus kind of making a check on a box saying out of compliance and then getting rid of that.
One of the things I noted is that a lot of the jails, or at least some of the jails, have actually contracted out medical care. You mentioned a group called WellPath, for example. These are apparently for-profit companies. How well has that worked?
I would say generally not very well. So those are generally national groups. I believe WellPath is one of the largest, if not the largest, for-profit medical provider that contracts with these facilities. And so there have been a slew of lawsuits against a number of those for-profit medical providers across the country, alleging different forms of kind of medical neglect, lack of training and staffing, et cetera. Some of the jails that we were looking at in this project had contracted out with some of those providers at various times.
Yeah, like Sophie said, some of these, like WellPath, the one that you referenced, yeah, some of these for-profit contractors have a pretty notorious track record, a lengthy list of lawsuits at other facilities. And yet, I mean, it's county officials that make these contracting decisions that ultimately enter into the agreement with them. There has been in some places, you know, pressure on county officials to look more closely at those contracts, especially in light of some of the lawsuits that reveal what can happen when corners are cut or things like that. But yeah, they contract with counties across the country despite this track record.
You make a few references in the article to various legislative efforts, one going back just to 2017, you know, the Sandra Bland Act. I hope most of our listeners are familiar with the case of Sandra Bland in Waller County. Ultimately, it was ruled a suicide. She had been pulled over for turn signal or some minor traffic infraction. And, you know, a few days later, she's dead in the cell.
We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. A quick update to the show. On April 28th, Michael Barajas and Sophie Novak were the recipients of the 2022 John Bartlow Martin Award for Public Interest Magazine Journalism from the Northwestern University School of Journalism. They were honored for Locked Up and Left to Die. Congratulations, Michael and Sophie. The following is an encore presentation that first aired on December 7th. The segment with Austin Sanders at the end of the program is new and was recorded on April 29th. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on December 2nd. Our guests this evening are Sophie Novak and Michael Barajas, writers for the Texas Observer. They recently authored Locked Up and Left to Die. We're discussing the Sandra Bland Act of 2017. Could either of you talk a little about that legislation, and has that had any impact in the last 4 years?
Yeah, it's like Sandra Bland's death became a national scandal because of the video showing how she was abused by the state trooper that pulled her over. The Texas Rangers ultimately investigated her death. So we had cite some details from that report in our story. And it really showed the degree to which, you know, jail staff just ignore or are callous to somebody who is tail spinning in lockup. It was clear she was having a hard time. She even told them about her history of suicide attempts, including a recent one that previous year, saying she was depressed. All these red flags that should have been taken seriously and were. In fact, they housed her in a cell alone because she was accused of assaulting the officers. So that was, you know, an aggressive offense to isolate her for. So her death sparked a movement to push for some reforms. There were some reforms at the county level, but at the state level, it was the Sandra Bland Act. And that included a number of things, including now we have a lot better data on traffic stops and searches because of the law. It's led to some really good reporting on that front recently. It also mandated that sheriffs commission outside investigations into jail deaths. They're no longer allowed to investigate themselves when this happens, which is what a lot of them had been doing until the Sandra Bland Act. So, I mean, I think as far as the reforms and what they've accomplished, I mean, for one thing, we know a lot more about what's happening in these facilities, especially when things go really wrong, because there's more investigations into them, right? This project that Sophie and I did, it wouldn't be the same without that reform. And so I think that's important. There's still, you know, some limitations to what's there. Like, these rangers' investigations aren't perfect. And it doesn't mean that local officials, local prosecutors, local sheriffs take what's in them seriously. So there's obviously still more to be done.
And I'll just add to that kind of last point that Mike makes. These reports, a lot of them exist because of that reform. But what we found is that often nothing comes out of them or after them. And so generally when the rangers are doing these investigations, they're looking for essentially criminal conduct that local prosecutors might want to pursue. That sometimes happens, but we found that that actually happens quite rarely following these investigations, even in cases where the rangers did uncover evidence of apparent criminal misconduct. And actually, in the example of Sandra Bland's death, the rangers' investigation into her death shows that guards had said that they had checked on her every hour as they were required to do under Texas law, but that surveillance video actually showed they left her unchecked for nearly 2 hours. That investigation documents falsification, a potential felony for tampering with government records, but a grand jury did not indict any of the jailers that were involved in her death. It was actually just the trooper who arrested her was fired and indicted for perjury, and then that charge was later dropped. And so there are a lot of other kind of reforms that came with the Sandra Bland Act, the kind of requirement of an outside investigation by a body like the Texas Rangers was a major one. But what we're still seeing is, in a lot of cases, kind of a lack of action after those occur.
I mean, I'll just add to that, like sometimes they don't even go to a grand jury. I mean, like Sandra Bland's case was high profile cases, the ones that end up that way end up having a grand jury hear the case. But there are a lot of these that we looked at that raise a number of serious concerns, including the one that Sophie just talked about, the possibility of potential felony by a jailer that said they did checks that that video proves they did not do. There are some that weren't taken to a grand jury because the death was ruled natural causes. And that's sort of like what was listed as the justification for not doing that in the report, which is, you know, I would say questionable because I've reported on instances where, you know, something was ruled natural causes, but there was criminal conduct involved and jailers were charged for it. So yeah, I think just to underscore that point, there's often very little done and for pretty questionable reasons, you know, to overlook some of this stuff.
And we're only talking about that kind of universe of potential criminal conduct, right? There's so many of these cases raised really significant red flags, were extremely alarming, were seemed to show the rangers pretty clearly documenting evidence of serious examples of medical neglect. And then, like Mike mentioned, those were ruled natural causes. It's not really something that the rangers would be looking for in terms of passing off to local prosecutors, because a lot of this might be kind of really alarming to us, might raise really clear red flags, but not necessarily be criminal conduct. And there is not really an entity that is holding folks accountable for those kinds of things.
On the matter of legislation, so many times we've had discussions about cash bail with the Texas Jail Project, with Amanda Wu and other activists here in Austin.
I think going into the 2021 legislature, there was a lot of momentum and high hopes that we'd finally be able to do something about the fact that the people who have the money don't stay in jail and the ones without are found there. And so you have a very heavy bias, you know, in the jail population to poor people, people of color, and so forth. Do you want to comment on what the 2021 state legislature did with all that?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it on this program before, Bob, how, you know, about the movement across the state to end wealth-based detention. You know, we talked earlier about how pretrial detention, putting people in lockup while their cases are adjudicated. That practice has ballooned over the past several decades, in part because of this increased reliance on cash bail. Magistrates, judges that set basically a price for your freedom instead of potential other options like, you know, court-ordered monitoring, other types of non-monetary condition of release that exist, and advocates have been pushing for judges to do more. You know, the biggest cities in the state, Houston, Dallas, not just on bail reform, but, you know, on a number of issues involving like policing, mass incarceration, criminal punishment, especially after the murder of George Floyd, there was a lot of hope. There was a George Floyd Act or a George Floyd bill that was introduced at the legislature by Democrats this session. And yeah, a lot of that stuff just got no traction in part because of this real backlash among conservatives to some of the bail reforms. A lot of fear mongering over crime statistics, in particular, just zeroing in on the rise in murders that happened across the country. Instead of having, you know, discussion about cash bail and who it keeps in and what are the conditions inside these lockups and any of those reforms to sort of ease the pressure on these like already overburdened, overcrowded facilities. Instead, there was a bail bill that was one of Abbott's priorities that was passed effectively for certain people to get out without paying cash bail. People charged with certain offenses, more serious offenses, but even just if they have that in their criminal history in some instances. And it kind of mirrors the executive order that Abbott put into effect during the pandemic to stop kind of what we were talking about earlier, where judges and local prosecutors were seeing the threat that COVID posed inside lockup facilities, acknowledging that this is a larger public health issue because what happens behind bars doesn't stay behind bars. Outbreaks in lockdown facilities eventually translate into the community. But Governor Abbott, like, you know, issued an executive order to try to stop those releases and then basically doubled down with a law this most recent session doing the same.
Well, in your story, you profile a number of cases. You lead off with one of Danny Carrillo. It'd be great to hear from two of you, kind of your own reflections on some of the cases that you highlighted.
Yeah, Danny was in his 20s. He was the youngest in his family. They were from right outside of Corpus Christi, kind of a little style ranch house where he lived with his parents. You know, the family I talked to said he had some issues. His record showed he'd been diagnosed with some substance use and mental health issues, diagnoses. So he had bounced in and out of lockup some, but yeah, they remembered him being kind of like the glue of the family in a certain way because he like would like to cook for everybody. So he'd invite people over for regular cookouts and stuff, his parents. And I mean, his case speaks to in some ways how easy it is to just end up in jail. His initial arrest was for scavenging for like scrap metal on the side of the road, actually outside of like an abandoned lot that his family used to own. Cops, for whatever reason, busted him and he entered into a plea agreement, a probation agreement for burglary, so he wouldn't have to do any time in lockup. Then he messed up and ended up cycling in and out of halfway houses and lockups. And that's kind of how he ended up back in jail before he lost his life. He was booked because of a probation violation and seemed fine, according to family and other people that were incarcerated with him. But his mental health started to obviously decline within a couple weeks. Everybody was worried about him. People that were incarcerated next to him, his dad, who was visiting him and talking to him regularly, everybody thought he was spiraling and they were all trying to warn guards about it. And the night he died, his family had come to visit him. He was not doing well. He freaked out during the visit. He wound up back in his cell. sounds like he was psychotic, according to the investigation, that he was, you know, hallucinating. Anyway, guards decided to move him in part. They gave conflicting reasons why. It was either he, you know, was kind of disturbing people on the cell block by yelling so much, or, you know, they also said that they were going to transfer him to a medical unit or something. But they stormed his cell, he swung at them, and he ended up pinned to the ground by a handful of guards. One of them stuck his knee into Danny's back, and another one actually shocked him with a stun gun. And nurses didn't come to check on him until about 10 minutes after all of that, but he didn't have a pulse at that point, and it was later ruled a homicide. We know a lot about Danny's case because his parents ended up suing, and they did get a little bit of money eventually in a settlement agreement with the county.
Sophie?
Yeah, another one that really stood out to us was Elmer Dale Barrett, who died at the Kaufman County Jail in 2019. He was a 70-year-old veteran. He was being held in the county jail. He was there for a few months. And pretty early on into his time there, he started asking for medical attention. Starting in March of 2019, he filed at least 4 different written requests for medical attention, asking to see a doctor, asking to go to the hospital, and telling jail staff that he thought he was having heart attacks, that he thought he was having strokes, that he couldn't feel one side of his body, that he really needed to see somebody. And he was quoted as telling jail staff that he was going to die in here. And he ended up dying in May of 2019 of complications from a heart attack. And the Rangers investigation into his death that we reviewed said that that heart attack may have happened approximately 3 to 7 days prior to his death. In the kind of course of him telling jail staff exactly what was happening to him and being ignored by the folks working at that facility. And I think that one really stood out to us. It's not in all of these cases where you have kind of such clear documentation of what is going on with someone and of them telling staff exactly what's going on and raising that alarm kind of so many times, so consistently, and really just not being listened to at all. He at the same time was sending letters to a close friend of his outside of jail, kind of saying the same things, you know, he really needed medical attention. And that his death was ultimately ruled, quote unquote, natural causes, which is this kind of giant bucket that encompasses, you know, most deaths that are not ruled suicides, homicides, are not overdoses, et cetera. That's just so striking to me because it seems like a very clear example of, you know, had he not been inside this facility where his ability to access medical care was entirely dependent on, you know, the people that were detaining him there and their kind of response to his pleas, it seems like there is a pretty good chance that this would not have happened to him. And yet that death was ruled, you know, quote unquote, natural. And that's a kind of pattern that we saw, you know, not necessarily in such kind of clear and stark terms as Elmer's case, but that's a pattern that we saw throughout a lot of these reports that we were going through of examples where it seemed like there were very clear red flags that went ignored, chronic conditions, potentially life-threatening conditions that went ignored, ending up being ruled natural causes. You know, we saw that specifically documented in a number of reports that, you know, there were cases where the local prosecutor specifically said that they didn't pursue any charges in a case because the death was ruled natural. And here we have kind of this example of what that can look like.
As we close here, what's your sense about what needs to be done? What kind of resources would be required? And you know, what are the prospects for real change in the situation? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Where I would start is just like a lot of things with criminal legal system. There's a ton of challenges, but that also means there's a lot of different avenues or opportunities for reform. We talked about the state jail commission earlier. There's a state body, the state watchdog, you know, agency has already identified a number of different reforms and fixes that the state could adopt or that the commission could adopt to put some more teeth to their sort of rulemaking and regular inspection process. You know, that wasn't prioritized by the legislature this time, and it's unclear what the jail commission exactly, if anything, is going to change in the rulemaking process this year. But we'll see. On like a political level, you know, there's local sheriffs that are in charge of a lot of these facilities that are ultimately, you know, in some ways the buck stops with them, with conditions inside of some of these places. So, like I said, we've seen some organizing around sheriff's races, but not as much as you've seen around a lot of other like progressive prosecutors and those sort of races, for instance. So I think tying these conditions to the sheriffs that are kind of responsible for them is something I've seen organizers doing more. County commissioners also have some degree of oversight of these facilities too. They could be, I don't know if any of them are, could be reading these rangers' reports about what's happening inside their local lockup and maybe respond.
Yeah, I think this is kind of less specific than what you outlined, Mike, but I think there's kind of a couple levels. Improving oversight, making some of these kind of connections, identifying patterns and doing something about them, that kind of work. There's this debate, I suppose, around, you know, investing more money and resources into facilities that are so dangerous and flawed, but that is one element here of needing more resources to have safer conditions for folks in these facilities. But that's kind of balanced with this larger conversation around bigger reforms to jail and prison systems. You know, how do we incarcerate fewer people in the first place and instead invest more funding in things like mental health care to try to divert people from these facilities to begin with? And so I think there's kind of a number of different things that could be done on kind of a range of different levels.
Yeah, there are mechanisms for accountability kind of in different places, but yeah, to Sophie's point, yeah, this is, a lot of these challenges are systemic, so they have to be also looked at that way too. Some of the behavior that's described by jail staff is just on its face callous, right? There's no getting around some of it. But I mean, other cases that we looked at, you know, it's not entirely that like things go wrong out of malice, but these are just, you know, incredibly stretched facilities because we use jails for a lot of different things. You've got a lot of people with substance use issues, they end up in jail. People with mental health issues, they end up in jail. People dealing with chronic homelessness, they often end up in jail. I mean, you've got people in these facilities dealing with incredible challenges, and a lot of them are very vulnerable. And that's in part why, you know, the conditions inside of these places is so important, how they're dealt with, because things can go bad really fast. So yeah, it's got to be part, I think, of this larger conversation of who should be in jail in the first place. Because I think a lot of the cases that we looked at here, it's difficult to see a public safety interest in having them in lockup.
Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for the work that you do covering this. It needs to be brought to light.
Every time we've had you on, Mike, I think about how fortunate folks who are incarcerated are to have a voice like yours, and now Sophie's too, to speak out about some of the shortcomings that are experienced in our incarceration systems here in the state of Texas. But I'll just say thank you so much for enlightening us, to both of you. This was truly a monumental task on your part to go through all of those records and to uncover what you did.
Thank you. And thanks so much for having us on.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob. I appreciate that.
Well, it's Friday, April 29th. And once again, we have Austin Sanders with us, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How you doing this morning, Austin?
I'm doing all right, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
You know, last year, a few times we talked about a petition drive that was being led by Julie Oliver and Mike Siegel. Could you fill us in about what happened between then and now?
Yeah, I think probably the reason you haven't heard much about it is it's not very controversial. This petition drive, unlike some of the other petition initiatives we've discussed on your show, Ground Game Texas, this progressive political organizing group led by Mike Siegel and Julie Oliver, set out to gather signatures for a ballot initiative that would basically decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana and ban the use of what are called no-knock warrants by the Austin Police Department. And neither of these measures are very controversial. the Austin Police Association, you know, usually very active in these types of campaigns, has not invested any money in opposing Prop A, which is how it appears on the May 7th ballot. And in fact, you know, Ken Cassaday, the president of the union, has kind of spoken out against prohibiting the use of no-knock warrants. He says it could be a danger. There are allow officers to execute warrants in a safer manner. In some cases, other experts would definitely disagree with that. But he definitely hasn't said much about the marijuana piece of the proposition. In fact, he's kind of, you know, an advocate for decriminalization at the legislature and wants it to happen. So there has not been much opposition at the petition gathering stage or the campaign stage. So yeah, Ground Game was kind of able to quietly gather their signatures and execute a campaign that they're virtually certain to win when polls close on May 7th.
You know, in Austin, this is like motherhood and apple pie. I mean,
yeah, right. And in fact, it's kind of been the status quo in Austin for the past year and a half, almost 2 years. But what the proposition would do is take what has become Austin Police Department policy and enshrine it in the city charter. And what that will do is make it more difficult to undo these changes, right? These policies. So we've talked in your show before about an effort by the Austin City Council in January 2020 to do this very thing, to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana. Council approved a resolution directing the police chief, at the time as Brian Manley, to take action on this. You know, at the time, Manley resisted. He eventually came around and enacted a policy that basically directs officers to not arrest or cite people for misdemeanor possession of marijuana. That's a state law. Basically, if you possess 4 ounces or less of marijuana, APD officers are not supposed to arrest you or ticket you. They just seize the marijuana and send you on your way. But this was just department policy. So any police chief at any time, for any reason, could change that, could go back to saying, hey, possession of marijuana is still illegal in Texas. So we're going to have officers write tickets if you're smoking a joint in public, right? Something like that. But if this proposition succeeds, it will become a part of the city charter that this is city law. And so the police chief can't just change that policy on his own. It would take a city council vote or another citywide election to undo that change. Similar story with the ban on no-knock warrants. What these warrants are is they have to be signed by an APD commander and a judge, and it allows SWAT teams or APD officers to execute a search warrant without announcing their presence. So they can show up to a person's house and bust in the door to begin making an arrest or seizing evidence. Police officials say that this is a useful tool when they're encountering someone they believe to be armed and a threat to officer safety. It gives them the element of surprise. Advocates say this is a danger. Primarily, they'll cite the case of Breonna Taylor from 2020, who was killed while the Louisville Metro Police Department executed a no-knock search warrant. She was a bystander in this apartment complex who was killed while in her bedroom, while the police department executed a search warrant on one of her neighbors, right? One of these no-knock search warrants. So, you know, advocates say that actually they are a threat to bystanders, to property, to other things of this nature. And so they shouldn't be used. So that has not been the policy at APD. They are still able to be used, but they are used sparingly. 5 or 10 years ago, APD would use them a lot to preserve evidence. If they were executing a search warrant on someone involved in a narcotics investigation, they would do one of these warrants so the suspect wouldn't have time to flush the evidence down the toilet or destroy it in some other way. But now they basically just use them if they think that the suspect is armed and a threat to officers. But if voters approve Prop A, they won't be able to do that at all. They'll be able to execute search warrants in a way where they have to announce their presence to the suspect, either knocking on the door, saying this is the Austin Police Department, or announcing from a safer distance if they believe the person may be a threat, waiting 15 seconds, and then they can bust in the door as they would with the no-knock warrant.
And really, these no-knock warrants kind of cut both ways, too. I mean, they can be dangerous for the police as well. who knows what they're going to encounter when they go bashing down a door.
Right. This is definitely an argument from advocates. In fact, in Austin, I think around 2016, there was a case where this happened. APD was executing a no-knock search warrant. The suspect didn't know it was the police breaking into his house. And so to defend himself, he fired at the officers. And I believe one was shot. And perhaps had the police announced themselves as law enforcement, the suspect would have behaved differently. We don't really know, but this is certainly the argument from advocates that when someone, whether it's law enforcement or not, breaks into someone's house, the person in that house rightfully may engage in self-defense. And so that can be actually more of a threat to officers, as valuable as the element of surprise may be, which again is what police officials point to as the value in these warrants.
Well, election day is actually Saturday, May 7th, and we'll be watching for the results at that point. Really appreciate your joining us here today and hope to have you back next week.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Well, that's all for this evening. Stay tuned for Co-op's local music mix on the HD3 channel and on koop.org. Stay safe, everyone.